You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Welcome to Crime Corner. Yes.
In a world.
Are you a white female?
It's
then
time
you're going
to
love this show.
Yeah.
Get a glass of wine, pop a Vicodin, and get ready to get scared.
Get a divorce, own a cat, light a candle and get ready for this. Get into the bath, ladies. Light a candle because it's time for some murder.
Authorities are desperately searching for a killer accused of going on a rampage.
The search for a possible serial killer.
An urgent manhunt for a man authorities believe is behind a triple killing spree.
Police here speculating that a possible serial killer may have struck again.
I told her to get out of the car, and that's when she became afraid, and then I shot her.
Welcome to our second episode of Crime Corner with Jesse Wiseman, or Jesse Wiseman's Crime Corner. We're
there
still
we
working
go.
On my yeah. crippling
still
sense of insecurity.
Workshopping the name.
Yeah. My crippling.
Wait for those focus groups to come back with whether they like the name first
top
or afterwards.
Or bottom. Mm-hmm. Whether they like mm-hmm. the name top or bottom, right?
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. We're doing a very certain kind of focus group. What? Okay, so today we're doing another horrific, horrible case. My favorites are the long, complicated, horrible cases.
This takes the cake, in my opinion, compared to the last episode.
Yeah,
this is worse than the last one?
Yes, but not the, like,
chopping babies'
of
heads
it.
Off and shit?
I think that in terms of... of being
horrifying. That wasn't bad, Joel's like, what the fuck is
yeah,
gonna happen?
That's why I brought my flash this time.
Sick fuck.
I'm learning really fast.
Wait, this one's not as bad as the baby chopping, head chopping one?
I think this one's a little bit more complicated.
Yes.
In terms of following the storyline.
Yes.
Great.
It has a lot more twists and turns. It's sort of like, it's like an M. Night Shyamalan film, except it's really well acted.
Yes, and the connection of characters, as well as the butterfly effect of and rippling effect of one decision that some creep made, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the amount of people through the years
walking home from school by himself.
Oh yeah,
ruined
oh, we're talking about
so
the victim.
Many lives.
Oh, okay, yeah, the victim's decision to be like a dumb 7-year-old
kid.
He's 7.
Every show that I'm on now, it's always about kids either getting fucked or killed.
Listen. He doesn't die.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doesn't die.
That's a plus.
Right? People do die because of... So we'll just tease it a little bit. It's about a kidnapping in the 70s. And okay. I think we're going to do some alternate... Another thing where we do like alternate titles, which is like this one might be the Stephen and Carrie Stainer case, : Oh, the 70s, right? Like, because the 70s were such a fucking different time where all these things that happened could not have happened now because of things we learned back then.
Particularly from things like this.
A bunch of boys getting taken.
A whole lot of kids going missing.
Yes. And like, we learned how to see the signs, not mind our own business, right? Like, I think part of this case is people just kind of minding their own business, not really wanting to ask too many questions, but the kidnapping ends up turning into a ripple effect that ends next episode, it's a two-parter, that ends with the death of four people.
With murder.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah. It...
And lots of characters that are connected that ended up getting affected by this one decision. Again, of the victim. No.
Seven-year-old boy.
Of this fucking creep that took this boy.
Well, I mean, give him some credit. He was a minister. He was just trying now, to... Trying
you can
to
tell me, a re- who, was he really?
No, he
wasn't. Okay, okay.
No, who are we talking about?
All right, let's get started. Sorry. That was just a little teaser.
Well, cheers, ladies.
Cheers. Episode two, we're actually fucking doing it, you guys. Yeah. We're doing it. All right, let's do it. Mm. Coop is going to be reading this because he has the voice of an amazing radio host angel.
70-year-old smoker.
An angel that is hosting a radio show, right? That's your voice that smoked for 20 years, and I love that.
Our favorite liquor store guy back in California called him the Golden Throat.
For different
reasons.
Did I
know him? What liquor store? Let's go nostalgic.
Meta Market.
Meta Market, right on Meta Street.
Meta and Hemlock.
Yeah.
Ugh. The days.
His name's Ray. He's from Syria. You probably recognize him.
I'm sure I met him. Oh, you know, I'm sure I met him, right?
Yeah. I've been there forever.
You know, lots of Syrian Christian refugees.
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely from the liquor stores in California. Yeah.
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 We wanted to take a picture with him, and he was like, oh, no, no.
Oh.
And like, I was like, no photos.
He
was
he was actually concerned about connections back home because he was a shit. Yeah, he fled the country in fear of his life.
Those are the best kinds.
I think that was only part of the story also. I have a feeling that Ray is going to show fear up as a topic for a future episode of Jesse Weissman's Crime Corner.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Mm-hmm. All right, so let's get into it. And I will, as always, interrupt you annoyingly.
I hope to God.
Okay, you welcome it?
And we do. This turned out to be... much longer than I was expecting.
I tried
to cut it off at five pages.
Right.
Ended up being about 7.5 pages.
We can do it.
Yeah, we can get through this. So without further ado, this is the part one of the Stainer Brothers.
Aw, the 70s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the full title.
Alternate title, yeah. the 70s.
The 70s, right?
That 70s abduction.
Is it aw, or is it like aw?
No, it's like nostalgic, like, oh, you know what I mean? How great were the 70s, right? You could just take fucking kids.
Now, that's what I call a 70s child abduction, volume one.
Yes!
The Stainers were a normal family living in the so-called Gateway to Yosemite, Merced, California. The family consisted of parents Delbert and Kay, along with three daughters and two sons. And it is these two sons, Stephen and Carrie, that will be the focus of our story. I tried to find the names of all three of his sisters. I could find two of them, Corey and Cynthia. Third sister apparently does not want to be found. Understandably so.
Hmm. Understandably, and also that's pretty indicative of what the family was like. If I don't know if you're getting into that, but
not exactly the Brady Bunch.
Not too touchy-feely. Pretty much we make sure they have food and water, right? And that's about it. And the 70s is like we let our 7-year-old walk home from school. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying? Where it's like I have an 8-year-old and I can't even imagine having him walk somewhere like after
you
school.
You don't let him walk home?
She doesn't let him walk at all. She carries him everywhere.
Yes, he's in a stroller still. Is that weird? Actually, baby Bjorn. I carry him out, though.
Now you're going to tell her that it's wrong that she's still breastfeeding him.
Yeah.
Wait until you have a child, Joel.
Now you're
going to
say the leash is weird. Come on, dude. But
don't even touch on the baby cage or she is going to go nuts.
That's a crib.
Leashes.
Yeah.
The leashes are cool.
Leashes are real. I hate, like, leash shaming is people that don't have kids. Anyone that has a kid or a toddler is like, got you. The leash is like, it's literally
your buzz
good.
Your level can be higher.
Yes. It's good parenting.
You pay less attention, yeah.
If old Kay Stainer had a leash, we wouldn't be doing this fucking story.
Okay, so thank God they didn't have baby leashes back in the 70s or else we wouldn't have an episode today.
Exactly.
So what was the town they're from?
Merced, California, Northern California.
So little town, I don't know. Like, they say it's the gateway to Yosemite, so it's literally right before you get to the park.
Yeah, surrounded by a lot of peach orchards and almond farms and right outside Yosemite. So, it, honestly, from the pictures that I've seen, it's a beautiful area.
Oh, yeah. Like this amazing area. It was easy for this to happen, and why it became so big is because not a lot of stuff happened there this.
Yeah, it also makes for a really good story.
Yeah.
Carrie Gregory Stainer, the oldest of the five children, was born on August 13th, 1961. Stephen Gregory Stainer was the middle child, born on April 18th, 1965. Despite the four-year age difference, the brothers had a close relationship growing up and spent much of their time outside of school together. Carrie looked out for Stephen, and Stephen looked up to Carrie. And I think it plays into the story in the long run.
Yes.
Delbert and Kay allowed their children to walk to and from school on their own. Merced was a safe town with very little crime. The year was 1972. Kevin Spacey was just a child living in New Jersey, and R. Kelly was still king in his pampers all the way in Chicago.
The Stainers, important to point out.
I'm just making sure everybody understands the Stainers had no reason to think that their children were at risk.
Right, because of those two people not being around.
Well, they're the greatest predators of our lifetimes. On December 4th, 1972, 7-year-old Stephen Stainer didn't come home after school. His family searched along the route he took every day to and from school, but nobody had seen hide nor hair of the young boy.
Well, can we say it wasn't until that night, too? So, like, it's one of those things that even a 7-year-old walking home from school, you would still be like, oh, maybe he went out.
Yeah.
Like, they still were like, right?
So, yeah, he's probably at the bar.
Yeah, they thought he was, like, dawdling home from school again and found some, you know, something else to do or whatever. So it wasn't, it wasn't until that night that they were like,
That's let's strange. Check. Our 7-year-old isn't here.
Yeah, and then they called the cops. So, yeah.
My sister and I have talked about this before, that the stuff that our parents let us get away with growing up, unimaginable for, like, my niece and nephew, because even when I was as young as Stephen Stainer, I would spend, especially during the summer, I would spend all day every day until after dark out in the hills of southeast Oregon, where there's cougars, there's coyotes, there's rattlesnakes everywhere, scorpions all over the place.
Right. But I think if
pedophiles.
I think your parents were probably like, well, if I have to choose between a, you know, cougar mauling and, like, a pedophile, 100% I would choose a cougar.
Cougar.
Like, I would rather find the kid, like, oh, man, you fought a good fight against the fucking cougar than that fucking crazy shit.
Thank God you didn't get molested. Unless the cougar molested you beforehand, and then that's just the worst-case scenario. In southeast Oregon, back in the 80s.
Right. Didn't you guys have that rule? My mom's rule was be home when the sun goes down.
Yeah, well, or when the lights come down, or, like, all that shit.
When the street lights come on.
That was probably their rule.
Oh, yeah, 100%, or lack thereof. It was literally like, you know, if he doesn't come home at a certain time, like, he had gotten in trouble for not, but
he's off with his girlfriend.
Right. There's, like, I mean, what were you?
7's pretty young, though.
You didn't start maybe thinking, like, an hour after he was supposed to be home? But anyways.
It's funny. My mom had a rule where as soon as it started getting dark, as soon as the sun started coming down, we had to be close enough to our house where if she whistled, we could hear her.
Oh, that's
she could whistle really, like, super, super loud.
Fucking redneck shit. That's fucking shit. Dang, Coop, I didn't know you had it like that.
So my sister and I, as soon as the sun started going down, we would make sure that we're close enough to the house, and then off in the distance, we would hear a whistle and be like, oh, shit, we got to run home or else we're going to get our asses whooped.
That's crazy.
And that's why we were never abducted.
It's very true.
So his family searched along the route he took to and from school every day, but nobody had seen hide nor hair of the young boy. It seemed as if he had disappeared into thin air. The Stainer family was understandably semi-devastated, considering the relationship they had with their children.
Right. One was
a bit worried.
Yeah, one was bummed. Like, the other one was like, well,
he'll show up.
Ah, he's fine.
Business as usual.
He's 7 years old. He could take care of himself. I had 2 full-time jobs by the time I was 7.
Yeah, they had a lot of kids, too.
Although the disappearance of Stephen affected the entire family, it seemed to be particularly hard on his father, Delbert, and his older brother, Carrie. And I mean that in the sense that it seemed to have more of a negative psychological effect on the two of them.
Or
his mom always kind of held on to hope that maybe he wasn't dead. And
she held on to hope, but she was also no offense, but she was also one of those moms that was just like not very, again, like touchy-feely, didn't show a lot of emotion, even
she's
in
got four
any
other kids, so
you know what I mean,
she's
though
got replacements.
Like all the interviews, it's very much just like, yeah, and so we thought, you know what I mean, like
it seems
very
like, yeah, both of the parents weren't affectionate,
right? But the dad for some reason was like really grieving about it, and kind of one of the problems was he would grieve, like smell Steven's clothes, like, and cry in front of Carrie. So in front of the other kid, the older brother would just like be grieving and like kind of did one of what's that movie, like Walk Hard, where he's like the wrong kid died, right? Like he would
the wrong son died.
Like he would kind of do that shit. Like he would say weird stuff like my real son and like all this. So we're also getting into the psychology.
Yeah, we'll get into a little bit of the story with Carrie on this one, right? Because he was largely neglected through this whole process, and he was very, very close with Steven too.
Right. So he was grieving, and then
did not care that this was affecting Carrie.
No, it wasn't about like making sure the kids were okay with it or anything. It was literally just like, oh God, our hero son, whatever. So
it's like, no, fuck you, I'm sad.
Yeah, yeah. And the boy's like, okay.
When the police and volunteer search parties were unable to find Steven, Delbert took matters into his own hands. Sort of like he kind of went Batman on this case for a little while. But
you fucking should, right? Wouldn't you?
You and Mel Gibson?
They both should.
Dude, I'd be like knocking on every door, like doing all the shit that you're not supposed to do.
It seemed like that's what Delbert was doing when they couldn't find his son, because he would literally follow any lead that he could find, and he would drive miles and miles away because somebody said, oh, I thought I maybe saw something that might be a dead body on this hillside, 30 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
So the worried father launched his own investigation, following leads and often driving for miles through the surrounding forests searching for Steven. As time wore on, he cared much more about Steven than he cared about Carrie, though.
Okay.
Did you read about the grandpa stuff?
The grandpa stuff?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
We'll get into it, I guess, after the abduction.
Okay, now I'm curious to hear about that. So as time wore on, Delbert knew that he was no longer looking for his son. He was looking for his son's body.
Fuck.
As Delbert continued his Sherlock Holmes-esque search for Steven.
Yeah.
You imagine like having to come to terms with that change?
The entire situation, even if they knew their son was alive but didn't know where he was, that would still be horrifying.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, at least just, you know they're alive.
That I think that would be one of the more difficult things, is not knowing.
Yep.
100%. You don't know if you should still have hope that you're going to see him again, or if you should come to terms with their death. Like, there's no closure when somebody just disappears.
And it's the idea of, like, looking at every single person, looking at every single car, looking at every time you pass something on the road. Like,
fucking
literally,
hell.
You'd
be in hell for a long
constant
time.
Right?
Yes, he disappeared in this town. Somebody in this town is most likely responsible for it. Who wasn't?
And so you're like, just, it must, like, kill you. But
it would.
Fuck. What would you rather?
Absolutely insane.
If you lost a kid, would you rather them be gone and know they're alive, but you can never get them back and you don't know what's happening to them? Maybe they're being tortured or whatever, but you know they're alive. Is that better?
Shit.
Or is it better just to know
that? How are you going to?
Or is it better to know they're dead?
That is a really.
That's a real meta world.
Yeah, I guess.
I did know they were alive, then I would be spending every, right?
You would never stop trying to get them back.
Yeah, and that would drive you insane.
If you knew that they were gone, but they were safe, and you could never see them again, it would be more comforting than knowing that they were just dead.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Knowing that they're gone and being tortured.
Yeah, you added the torture part there.
Well, you don't know their situation.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, knowing that they're gone but still alive,
But you just think they're everyone. That's what they do, right?
That
you think
tricky.
That they're alive until you
yes,
know
100%.
For sure they're dead.
100%. Your mind won't. Literally every single person that has like had to be told that a body is somewhere instead of them finding it, the family 100% up until that moment thinks that there's a chance.
Yeah.
And 100%, no matter what.
I've also heard, from stories that if somebody has been missing for long enough, somebody finally discovering the body is a relief because yes. they finally know
once
what
they've
happened.
Gotten it's, to that point.
It's awful, but it's like it's closure.
Yes. Yeah, it's closure. It's
so that you're not
putting a nice little button on the whole situation, so you know what you have to deal with next.
Yes,
and you start the next process, like the grieving
right.
process.
Right.
Yeah,
trying to move on. Fuck.
So as like Delbert continued his Sherlock Holmes-esque search for Stephen, Carrie suffered in silence. His parents were so focused on the loss of one son that they began neglecting the other, and Carrie was left to work through his grief alone. Carrie would often go outside alone late at night, look at the sky, and wish upon a star that his brother would return home safe. The stress and loneliness led him to develop a form of obsessive-compulsive disorder, which caused him to pull out chunks of his hair, leaving behind bald patches that he would keep hidden under a hat. And
holy
this is a
shit.
This is a kid in his like early teens.
Yeah, his hormones are kicking in. Perfect timing for this to happen for him.
Yeah, perfect timing, especially with two loving parents helping you through the whole situation. Yeah.
Sure.
By 1980, the Stainers had pretty much accepted that Stephen was dead. Although Kay was still hopeful that her son may miraculously be found alive someday, Delbert knew if the police ever found anything, it would likely be a corpse. It had been 7 years since Stephen had gone missing, and the likelihood of him still being alive was practically non-existent. Then in March of 1980, Kay Stainer received a phone call. On the other end of the line was a detective who told her that before he said anything else, she should probably sit down. It was about Stephen.
Shit.
She knew this was the call that the family had been dreading for nearly 10 years. Kay took a seat, and the detective gave her the news. Stephen was alive.
I knew it.
They found
right?
him.
Right?
Holy shit, he's alive.
What I like is Joel going through the journey like...
I told him
in
before
real time.
Before this episode, I was like, don't look up anything about the episode. It's going to be a lot better if...
Yeah.
It lands a lot better if you don't know what's going on.
So now he's like 14?
14 years old.
Fuck. And his big brother... He's like 18
so
now?
So his brother would have been 18 at the time.
Yeah.
He was 4 years older. On March 1st, 1980, Stephen Stainer showed up at a police station in Ukiah, California, with a 5-year-old boy named Timothy White. Little Timmy had been reported missing after he was abducted from his front yard the previous month, and once in police custody, Stephen began to tell the story behind his 7-year absence.
Oh, shit.
Ooh, I like it. He's Tarantino-ing.
Wait, so how far away is
that? I like
that
how you did this.
Town from the other town.
Well, they moved around a lot. Ukiah is, I want to say Ukiah is like maybe like 40 miles away from Merced.
40, yeah.
So someone drove from there.
Well,
I guess
well,
we'll find
they
out.
They
whole,
moved around.
That was where they eventually moved, but like you'll hear in the beginning, for a while they were only like 30 minutes from the family.
Not only that, first
Fuck.
Place they went was about 100 yards from his grandpa's house.
Oh, so they went to the grandpa's house. That was the grandpa stuff. Let's go.
I don't dig real deep into the grandpa stuff because the
okay
the. Details of everything else is a little bit more...
I like to dig deep into grandpa stuff, so I'll do it.
Oh, shit. Like,
there was...
You like grandpas?
Yeah,
like
dude.
Kurt Russell as Santa Claus?
Yeah, yeah. I
oh,
like grandpas.
God, hell yeah.
Fat grandpas? Hello.
Mommy or daddy.
Daddy.
This is the second episode in a row that you've been talking about your love for chubby old men.
Oh, yeah. And you know what I haven't said yet?
The end.
Prolapse.
I said it. Don't worry, I won't go into it. Okay, I've got it out of the way. Yeah. Guys, oh my gosh, I feel so much better. Okay, let's do this thing. I know, I was waiting.
I'm proud of you for holding back for damn near 30 minutes at this point. That must have been torture.
Yeah, people at home are like, she's acting a little bit weird, kind of quiet, right? That we're good now.
Anybody watching the video is like, why is her eye twitching?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You have to drink every time Jesse says prolapse from now on.
Back on that cold winter day in 1972, Stephen was on his way home from school when he was approached by Irvin Edward Murphy. Not Eddie Murphy.
I had a completely different idea. Not Eddie Murphy.
Eddie Murphy's brother.
Eddie Murphy's brother. Murphy was a simple-minded man who worked at a resort in Yosemite National Park. While working at the park, he met a sick bastard named Kenneth Parnell.
Mm.
And Kenneth Parnell is the first villain of our story.
Yes.
Kenneth.
I think I would venture to say the main villain because...
Absolutely.
Like I was saying in the beginning, everything kind of ripples from his bullshit.
And I would say every single person in this entire story is his victim.
Yes.
He's a mastermind. A
very manipulative person. Like, frighteningly manipulative.
Yes.
Okay.
Parnell was a convicted child rapist who posed as a minister in order to convince Murphy to help him abduct a young boy.
Holy shit. Parnell claimed
that he was a God-fearing man who just wanted a son to raise in what Murphy said was, quote, a religious type deal. Sadly, Parnell had more in common with Catholic priests than an actual Baptist minister. And that was a pedophile.
Bro.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Shots fired, dude.
Yeah, but fuck you, Vatican.
Yeah, I know.
Murphy was very simple-minded. And,
like, the IQ, I think, was very low.
Yeah, and he actually... It honestly seems like he didn't know that he was doing anything wrong. And Stephen Stainer himself even defended him later on.
Either he didn't know or the threats were worked on him because of his...
Yeah.
Yeah. Both. Both could be true.
So as Stephen made his way home, Murphy approached him and explained that he was gathering donations on behalf of the church. Murphy asked if Stephen's mother might have any items to donate, to which the boy replied yes. And at this point, Parnell pulled up in his white Buick, and the men offered to drive Stephen home.
And he was really only, like, he was really close to his house.
Why
it was, like, raining. I think it was raining. It was a really cold, rainy winter day.
It was sleet is what I heard, but I don't know what the fuck sleet is. I think it's just really cold rain. It's not snow, but...
Yeah.
Stephen climbed into the car with the supposed men of God and then spent the next 7 years in hell.
Holy shit.
And at this time, I don't think that Stephen... well, considering his age, there was no way that he could have known what type of danger he was in.
Right.
They came together to get him?
Yeah, so...
this dumb dude and
so Parnell was 41... And Murphy was younger than him.
Right? Yeah, he was in his, I want to say, like, early to mid-30s.
Oh, okay. So Parnell was, like, the mastermind, and he kind of used someone else to sort of vouch for him, right? So,
did Stephen know the guy because he lived there?
No.
No.
He didn't know either one of them?
No.
But, again, all the 70s, people taught their kids to be, like, polite and nice and sociable, and there was no... The term stranger danger has not even been a thing yet, or that idea that, like, it was something that we all really need to think about.
Yeah.
It was like these, you know, that happens to, like, this person, one-offs, it's not a big deal. So...
Both Stephen and Timothy spent the later parts of their lives going around lecturing children to not trust... strangers. Yes. And that's why I think that when I was growing up in the 80s, that was like a major thing. You don't talk to strangers.
There was like passwords for like people picking you up.
Yes,
like
I remember
all
that.
The shit. The schools got way more on.
I could party.
He was like, no need for a password here, right? I'm down.
It's like, wait, what's the password?
Yeah.
Just
whatever
kidding.
They
just
said. Like, whatever they care. Said, you were like,
yep, cool. You got it.
You got it. That's the one.
You got candy in that panel van?
Yeah. Puppies? Perfect.
Sweet.
I love both those things. But, yes, so there was no, yeah, there was no, again, stranger danger. There was no, you weren't taught to fear that.
Yeah, I think this was one of the cases that kind of brought that to prominence because it blew up nationwide.
Yes. Yes.
Like, even while Stephen was still missing, it was like it was on the news nationwide.
Yes.
So it's one of the cases that kind of everybody else learned from.
Yes.
When Parnell began driving, Stephen noticed that they weren't driving to his home. He asked the men where they were going, and Parnell told him that he thought it would be fun if Stephen spent the night at their house. I hate spending the night at somebody's house who I know. I'm like, no, just let me go home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even, and I'm talking as a 38-year-old.
Yeah. Like,
yeah, just I'm done. Let me go home.
Yeah. But if you're like a nice 7-year-old, someone could get you to do that.
Oh, dude,
100%.
I am blown away that I was never kidnapped as a child because yeah. I was, even after being lectured about stranger danger, I was so fucking polite.
Yeah.
That if somebody was like, no, just come with me.
You just don't want them to, you don't want to make them feel bad. You know what I mean?
I don't want to hurt this pervert's
feelings. I just don't want any awkwardness. So I'll just get in the car.
So they said that they thought it would be fun if Stephen spent the night at their house, and they would make sure it was okay with Stephen's parents, of course.
Yes.
Parnell then took the frightened and confused boy to a cabin in Cathy's Valley, which I think was about like 15, 20 minutes away. He liked to stay in places that were outside of town.
Yes.
Wow. So he was close the whole time?
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning?
In the beginning.
Well, I mean, it, like,
the whole time literally... they were looking like... In the beginning when there were searches and stuff like that, yes, he was very close.
Literally the entire story takes place within 40 miles of his family's
yeah.
house.
Yeah.
That's
which
crazy.
So that has to be
Daddy could
so...
have found him. So he was probably close a couple times.
Yep.
Well, if he actually was Batman, he could have found him. But he's not the greatest detective on earth. He's just some asshole who doesn't hug his kids.
Right.
Kenneth Parnell wasted no time before getting what he actually wanted with young Stephen. During their first night at the cabin, Parnell molested him, and then the abuse escalated from there. We're not going to be going into details
Don't
because
worry.
Even Good. Stephen wouldn't even give the details on it.
Right. Parnell did, but we don't need to get into that.
Yeah, we don't need
it
to
was,
get into that.
It was every day.
It was
oh, fucking
for 7 years.
Every day?
It was bad. Well,
so what, he just got too old, so he's like, yeah.
100%.
You're actually exactly
fucking
right.
Hell,
dude. Oh, you kind of have, like, the mind of a pedophile.
Shut up. Don't you dare say that.
I'm joking. Cut that out. That's not a funny joke.
No, leave that in.
Okay?
We need
We
need everybody to know us as characters.
Yeah. So now I'm the pedophile?
Bro.
Hey,
cut all this out.
Your choice of words, not mine.
Okay, go.
I mean, this is a bad part to get back in. Within 2 weeks, Parnell was raping Stephen on a regular basis,
sure.
as we just said.
Sure.
After being separated from his family and repeatedly abused, Stephen began begging to be taken home.
Did they tie him up and shit? Like, how?
No.
Just wait until...
So the manipulation...
Because he's old
of...
enough to try to get away.
No,
right,
the mental manipulation...
Of a 7-year-old, that's why we like...
He got mentally...
Yeah,
tired.
Like, that's why we talk about, like, 7-year-old, like, 7 to, you know, up to, like, 13 or whatever, 12 probably.
He had him mind-controlled.
You are able to... And for as long as a kid believes in Santa, do you know what I mean? Like,
you can get them to believe literally anything.
Yes, and especially if you're an adult, they're a child, like...
I believed
like,
in Santa until I was, like, 21.
Right?
Yeah.
So
now imagine how devastating it was when you learned that Santa wasn't real and at the same time you're being sexually molested.
God damn.
Fucked
it's not
up,
funny,
dude.
But
it's, yeah.
Motherfucker.
Kenneth Parnell was a fucking monster. And
yeah.
So he was not only able to manipulate a 7-year-old, which, I mean, a 7-year-old who hasn't been taught to distrust strangers and
yes.
and distrust certain adults, it's going to be that much easier. But Kenneth Parnell was able to manipulate full-blown adults.
Yes.
So he had
Had this forest ranger manipulated too.
The resort worker Murphy. He's not even the only person there the whole time. He was there, and Steven said that Murphy was actually kind to him. Right. That Murphy was as much of a victim as he feels like Murphy was as much of a victim as he was.
And Murphy wasn't doing anything naughty?
Mm-mm.
No. No, he was a peon. He was an accomplice.
Like I said,
he was mentally slow.
And he either knew the first night he kind of like was fighting with Parnell about it after, like the next day, like what the fuck. And Parnell somehow was like, dude, was able to tell him, this is basically your fault too. If I go to the cops, you're the exact same. So you will be in just as much trouble as I am. So just like.
What the fuck?
As if the physical abuse wasn't sadistic enough, Parnell began to play twisted mind games with the young boy. He told Steven that this is his home now. Parnell claimed that he had been granted legal custody of Steven. His parents were struggling to support so many children, and they had willingly given up their youngest son to cut back on bills.
Whoa.
Parnell also convinced the boy that arguments his parents had previously had were all Steven's fault. They wouldn't want him back even if they could afford to get him back.
Yeah.
He convinced Steven that his family didn't want
him. He believed it because, like,
it was already shitty there.
Yeah. A couple of those things were true.
Had fights before.
Yeah.
But, well, the crazy thing is Parnell didn't know about that at that point. He was just taking a shot in the dark, like, oh, have you ever seen your parents fighting before?
Mm-hmm.
And Steven's like, well, yeah. He's like, yeah, that was your fault.
Yeah. Right.
They don't want you back.
He was smart enough too, smart and monstrous enough to be like, did you do something that you did recently is the reason why you're here? Can you think of anything that you did?
Just getting him to say everything and using it
against
him.
So he was like,
that's why that's not admissible in court, because that's called leading the witness. And that's exactly what he was doing.
Right. So he was like, can you think of anything? And he was like, yeah, they had gotten mad at him like 2 days before and was like really pissed. So like he was able to, he's a master.
Yeah.
With kids anyways.
Parnell not only took Steven's innocence away, he took away his identity. He began calling the boy Dennis Parnell, telling neighbors and acquaintances that that was his son. For the next several years, Parnell moved Steven from city to city, never staying in one place long enough to get caught. He started calling him Dennis Gregory Parnell. He kept the same middle name and the same birth date and would use that information to enroll him in school.
He was going to school?
Dude, we'll get into it later.
Yeah,
but
let me go to the grandpa stuff really quick. Dig into the grandpa stuff.
Oh, yeah. I like digging into grandpa's.
So when the dad went on his rampage like the first couple days looking for him, he went to... I think his father's or his wife's father's house, grandpa, and was yards away, like literally two houses down.
Less than 100 yards away.
And it was his, you know, it was the grandpa who was like estranged and shitty and they hated him and was always like, you need to get rid of one of those kids, blah, blah, blah. So clearly he was like, let me check grandpa's house first. What he didn't know is that he was literally right next to the dude.
And Steven didn't know that either, because if Steven would have known that, there's a chance that if he would have had a better relationship
with his grandpa
and would have known where he lived,
he would have known where he was.
He would have been familiar with the place and he would have found his grandpa's house.
To stay under the radar, Parnell tried to keep an outward appearance of normalcy. He enrolled Steven in school in whatever city they were living in, and he allowed him to have friends and at one point even gave him a dog. A Manchester Terrier named Queenie. It was actually a gift from Parnell's mother, and Parnell just gave him the dog. And Steven later said that Queenie was the only positive aspect of his life during his captivity. I couldn't find out what happened to the dog, though. I'm assuming it's probably nothing happier than anything else in the story.
Yeah, probably everything in this story sucks.
This is fucking terrible.
We haven't.
Joel's
even,
like, I don't want to do this show.
Yeah, what did I give myself
into? I know. Dude. Haven't even gotten to the second twist. No, there is a bright point. I think that there's a very bright point, because once I started writing out the closing to the episode, I was like, okay, this is actually kind of, I mean, it's tragic, but at the same time, it's kind of beautiful.
Yeah.
We'll get to that at the end. Oddly, for the majority of his time with Parnell, Stephen was left mostly to his own devices. He was frequently left unsupervised while Parnell was at work, and he could pretty much come and go as he pleased. Stephen would later admit that he had countless opportunities to flee, but he didn't know how to find help. Besides that, Stephen still believed that his family didn't want him. Even if he did escape, where was he going to go?
Right.
When Stephen was 9 years old, a woman named Barbara Mathias moved in with Parnell. She lived with Parnell and Stephen for a little over a year and a half, during which time she joined in on the sexual abuse of Stephen, and she even helped Parnell in another kidnapping attempt, which was thankfully unsuccessful. Mathias later claimed that she had no idea that Stephen wasn't Parnell's biological son, and she also denied sexually abusing Stephen, although he maintained that she raped him on at least 9 occasions. She may have kind of helped a little bit with the failed abduction of another child, but people do crazy things for love. Just look at Will Smith. And much like Will Smith, Barbara was never punished for her crimes. She was never even arrested.
Cool. So she was out
there. When did she come in the picture?
She was there about 2 years. Two years after he was abducted, and she was around for about a year and a half. So a little while after he was 10 years old is when she left, and she got picked up to be questioned about the entire kidnapping case. They were just like, "Ah, okay, fuck it, whatever, get out of here." Never faced any punishment.
Crazy.
Even after it came to light that she tried to help Parnell kidnap another kid. Still
yeah,
just got out.
Oh, the 70s, right? It's really just like, meh, but you didn't really do anything.
How old is she? Hopefully she's fucking dead now.
At this point, yeah, she's definitely dead.
Yeah.
Good.
Something many of you know about children is that they have a tendency to grow up. Something else many of you know is that pedophiles are attracted to children. So as Stephen grew into a teenager, Parnell began to lose interest in him and left him to do pretty much whatever he wanted. Stephen was allowed to drink, smoke, and do pretty much anything else that popped into his mind because Parnell was too busy looking for his next victim.
He would, like, have friends over. Like, this is what I mean by, like...
He never told anybody?
He had a full-blown
exactly,
life.
Exactly. Like, him being able to, like, go to school and, like, this Parnell guy being able to enroll him in school and say that, like, his dad died and his mom left and all these...
Whatever bullshit story.
Yeah, but, like, now...
You can get away with it because it's... Oh,
the 70s. Oh, right? The 70s. The darn 70s.
The
those
heyday
were the
of America.
Days. Yeah. And nobody's really questioning. Nobody really wants to, like, get into anybody's business. So it's like, sure, you're the guardian. You're enrolling him
in school.
He must
have been a good kid, too, because usually, like, a fucked up kid
was
a bully.
Like, that was the
or
thing.
Or get in trouble at school and shit.
Neighbors, what they would notice is they would notice that he had dirty fingernails and
yeah,
he would
never...
wear the same clothes all the time. They could tell that he wasn't being taken care of, but I don't want to get in my neighbor's business. That's rude. Yeah.
Right. The idea of, like, calling DSS on anyone or, like...
See something, say something.
Any of that
didn't exist
was just,
back
like...
Then.
Yeah.
Kenneth Parnell began using Stephen to help him kidnap another young boy. Having endured... This is where... Major respect to Stephen.
Yeah.
Stephen's the hero of this fucking story.
Yeah.
Having endured years of abuse at the cold, clammy hands of Parnell, he wasn't about to let another child experience the horrors that he had. Stephen secretly sabotaged every attempt that Parnell made to abduct another child. So Parnell recruited another teenager to help him out.
Yeah.
One of Stephen's friends.
The hell?
Randall Sean Poorman was a friend of Stephen's that spent a lot of time taking advantage of the fact that Parnell didn't give a shit if they drank or smoked. Parnell convinced Poorman to become his accomplice by promising to give him drugs and money. So Poorman agreed, and they set their sights on Parnell's next victim, Timothy White. And we mentioned Timothy White earlier. He's the one that showed up at the police station with
50 miles
with
away
Stephen.
From the house, yeah.
No, at this point, they're actually in at this point, they're living in Ukiah. So they showed up at a local police station.
I mean, I meant 50 miles from his parents.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, roughly 50 miles from his home. Poorman spotted 5-year-old Timothy White playing in the front yard of his home in Ukiah, California. The teenager attempted to convince Timmy to get into Parnell's car, but he refused and attempted to run inside. Poorman grabbed Timmy White and dragged him kicking and screaming into the back seat of the car. He was to become Parnell's replacement for Stephen. And the story of Timothy being abducted sounds so horrible because Timothy was literally holding on to the chain link fence.
Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah.
Once Parnell got Timmy home...
That's, like, lazy, too, right?
Yeah.
For Parnell, like, use your mind manipulation.
Use your fucking shit, dude. Like,
well, that's why you don't get a teenager to do the fucking job.
Exactly.
Oh, the teenager dragged him in.
Yeah. If Parnell would have gone himself, he probably could have manipulated the kid into...
Yeah, or if the kid ran, he would have just went on to the next one.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Once Parnell got Timmy home, he put the boy through the same mind games he had used on Stephen. And this all happened much quicker than it did with Stephen. The manipulation process where it's like, oh, I want you to replace this other kid who's getting way too old. He's way past his prime. He dyed the boy's blonde hair dark brown and told him his new name was Tommy. Stephen watched the situation play out in front of him, bringing back terrible memories of what Parnell had put him through all those years ago, and Stephen wasn't going to let Timmy go through the same nightmare. Fucking hero.
How old is he right now?
So he's 14?
Yeah, at this point he's 14.
He's like 14. Timmy's
five.
Mm-hmm. Fucking hell.
But...
I can't do this show.
No, Stephen did not let the same thing happen to him. I can't imagine at 14 years old being ballsy enough to help this little kid after being manipulated and abused for 7 years.
14's
like,
a good age.
Now,
leave
now,
me.
I'm,
start getting
now
your
I'm done.
Man hormones though. You start getting pissed off and shit. Yeah.
Oh, he manned the fuck up big time because Stephen took Timmy under his wing, looking out for him the same way his older brother Carrie had done for him all those years ago.
Fuck yeah.
For the next 16 days, Stephen did everything that he could to protect Timmy, all the while waiting for his opening to return him to his family. Then, on March 1st, 1980, he finally made his move. While Parnell was at work, Stephen took Timmy and fled the 7-year-long nightmare that he had been through. The house they lived in was in the boondocks outside of Ukiah, so the two boys walked down the road until a passing truck picked them up and drove them into town.
Oh, you're getting into another truck, bro.
Yeah.
That was the first thing that I thought.
You gotta take
the risk.
Buddy,
man,
just
you're
walk,
just
man.
Out of the
just
frying
walk.
Pan and into the fire. God.
Can but you fucking imagine?
Fucking 20
can
miles?
You fucking imagine? He gets into a fucking...
And it's Leatherface. Come back to my house wearing a fucking...
Jeez. With this family, that would not surprise me if that, like, that's the part of it. But go ahead.
So, being only 5 years old, Timmy wasn't able to tell the driver where he lived, so instead, Stephen took the boy to the Ukiah police station. The series of events that happened with this truck driver, like, I was finding a lot of conflicting and confusing information, because at one point... They pulled over to look at a phone book, and the phone book is where Stephen got the address for the local police station and then got a ride to the police station. So who the fuck was this driver that picked him up? And they're just like, oh, young boys out in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
Who?
Just tell me where, again.
I bet you Stephen
was.
The 70s.
But also, Stephen was probably like not trusting the driver either. So I was like, oh, we just want to get to town.
You know what?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
we need to make a phone call, call somebody.
That's a good point.
True.
And then when he went to the phone book.
Then he got the police station and was like, just take me here.
Just take me here.
Nice.
Actually, yeah, that's a really good point.
It's actually probably totally.
Once they were dropped off at the police station, Stephen told Timmy to go inside and tell the police who he was. Timmy started to go inside, but got scared and ran back into the arms of Stephen.
Well.
An officer inside saw this and approached the boys, asking them who they were. Needless to say, when they found out who they were shocked. I mean, Stephen, he's been... So, Timothy White went missing less than a month earlier. He went missing
right,
the previous
so that
month.
Was
it's
like
been
fresh.
16 days. They know who he is.
How long was he gone for?
16 days. And Steven Stamer at this point has been missing for 7 years. So they find out about Timothy. They're like, oh, holy shit, you're the kid that's been missing for over 2 weeks now. Great. Who are you? It's like, oh, yeah. I'm Steven Stamer. They're like, what?
What? Yeah.
It would be absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It was at this point an officer called Kay Stamer and told her that she needed to sit down before he told her the news. After 7 long years, Steven Stamer was finally reunited with his family, and what followed was a whirlwind of media attention and interviews. Steven briefly went through therapy, but soon left, refusing to disclose the full details of his abuse.
Yeah, fuck that.
After the nightmare they had endured, both Steven and his family had difficulty readjusting, and as the way Steven described it, quote, I returned almost a grown man, and yet my parents saw me at first as their 7-year-old. After they stopped trying to teach me the fundamentals all over again, it got better. But why doesn't my dad hug me anymore? Everything has changed. Sometimes I blame myself. I don't know sometimes if I should have come home. Would I have been better off if I didn't? End quote. That is...
Interesting.
That is...
And he also comes home. Part of the story is like... He had been at Parnell's, as shitty as it was, he had so much freedom. So, like, no rules, nothing.
Smoking. Probably stopped getting fucked with as he got older.
Right. So, smoking, drinking, hanging out with his friends. Like,
trying to get him pubic hair.
No bedtime, never needing. So, like, when you go back to your parents' house, where you actually.
I have to shower every day? Dude, fuck is this shit?
I guess he
I'd rather get fucked.
I can't smoke.
Yeah, he was full on like smoking still, drinking. His parents were like,
what the fuck?
I know.
It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, but it's
to you?
Like, what are you going to do? Like,
he grew up a whole lot in those 7 years and he had to go back to being treated like a child again.
And rules and
also,
and like,
also yeah. obviously still neglected by his parents.
Yeah. It wasn't just like, oh my God. It was like, and all right, well, back to the fucking.
They don't even know each other anymore.
Exactly.
Too.
Yeah.
7 years is a long fucking time.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, from 7 to 14? That's a completely
That's like 30
person.
Years, yeah. like, growing
comparatively, yeah.
For sure.
Steven returned to school, where he was bullied by the other kids, and this made me so fucking mad to find out about.
Right.
Teenagers, being the sociopaths that they are, made fun of Steven for being kidnapped and molested.
Oh, yeah, fuck me.
Well, first, he wouldn't, again, like you were saying, he wouldn't say anything. So he was like, what people were believing... In all the interviews, they would come and interview him at school. There was no real rules, again, the 70s, with
the 70s.
Kids
media
protection
and
stuff.
Like the news would just literally be like in his classroom, right outside his class. There was no like protecting the child that just went through like the worst thing ever. They would just have a microphone in his face no matter where he was.
Fuck.
And he was maintaining that. You know, he just, you know, Kenneth Parnell just kind of wanted a kid. I was taken care of. I was fine. I was just away from my family. And so there was no, he just did not want to talk about what else happened.
And regardless of the fact that he was abused, just having that much media attention is going to, it's going to put a target on your back for all the other kids.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And
so even if it was for something
fuck.
Good,
yeah.
they would still make fun of him
sure.
for it. But the shit that they were making fun of him for... Kids are monsters.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially in the 70s.
The 70s.
The bullying led Steven to drop out of school, and he began to once again drink heavily. Due to his alcoholism, his father, once intent on finding his son no matter what, kicked him out of the family home. And this is within like a year of coming home. It's like, oh, you've been gone for 7 years. So happy to have you back.
Get
oh, you're not adjusting well.
Yeah.
Get the fuck out.
But you're like annoying now. Like,
wait, you want a hug?
Yeah, you want a hug.
Get out.
You want a hug and you have a drinking problem because of what happened to you. Get the fuck out of my
get
house.
Get the fuck out of my
what
house.
What else do
bro?
You want next? Therapy.
Yeah. Oh, and the dad was actually very against therapy because the '70s. It was like. Huge stigma, and the dad was
looked down upon.
A 70s hardcore dad that was just like, no son of mine's gonna, you know, let's just get things back together, let's just get it back.
You're
right?
fine now,
you're fine.
Your
Come
7 years of abuse
off.
Are making me look bad,
exactly. Walk it off, son. He's like, oh, I kind of need to talk to somebody. Nah,
man up,
yeah.
Stephen went on to marry his sweetheart, Jody Edmondson, in 1985 while they were both still in their late teens. Jody was 17 years old when they got married.
Yeah, from high school, babe?
Yeah, high school sweetheart.
Okay. And he's by that point, he's really good at sexual stuff.
Oh, God, Joel.
Dang.
Probably blew her fucking mind.
Cut it out. Cut that out. You're too into your character right now, dude.
Blew her fucking mind first night, dude.
So many bloopers in this
one. Are you a virgin,
one?
Too? No, I'm not. I've been fucking for 7 years.
Yeah. don't ask me about it, but she was in high school. I think she was like very protective of him and like help, you know what I mean? So that's how they connected.
It's not that they related, like, yeah, she felt.
So like, if people
she was
bullying,
like, she was like one of the few people that was sympathetic towards him.
Yeah. She would like make sure he's okay and be nurturing.
So the couple went on to have two children, a daughter named Ashley and a son named Stephen Jr. From there, Stephen became a Mormon and began speaking with children about stranger danger on behalf of a child abduction group.
Fuck yeah.
I absolutely love how caring he was towards anybody else that might possibly face the same situation.
Is something bad against
him? He saved Timothy White's life.
Turned into a fucking killer or something? What's happening here?
Not him.
Yeah.
So he did it. He came out of the darkness and is now
you
trying
can
to
rest,
help people?
You can rest assured, Joel, that Stephen Stainer did nothing bad after he,
Stephen Stainer killed nobody, and you can rest assured that this story is not done being sad.
He did not kill four people in Yosemite, okay? Well, no, I just want to let you know if that's what you were thinking.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean?
I mean, that's a natural conclusion that I would come to.
Yeah, mom and her daughter and an exchange student. But other than that, but he didn't.
No,
but he
Stephen,
didn't do it.
Stephen
no,
Stainer
I'm
never
being
did
totally
that.
Serious.
Stephen Stainer never killed.
I don't believe you guys now.
No, but Stephen
Stainer never killed four people in Yosemite National Park.
Jesus Christ.
No, but we're being serious.
Okay.
No, I'm
we're not telling you something else, but he never did anything else bad.
And then he tried to give back to the community?
Yes, and he was a great dad and husband and, like, you know, besides like a couple bouts with drinking, which, like, who among us?
I would.
Who among us doesn't have
I think he gets a free
problem.
Fucking pass.
Oh, dude.
I have been through much less, and I probably drink much more than he does.
Exactly. He should be smoking sticks and drinking hard alcohol every single day. And everyone should be like, yes, my friend.
You,
fine with me.
You earned
That's what
it.
I'm doing.
Yes, yes.
You earned it.
Exactly.
Stephen's story was eventually turned into a television miniseries called.
For Stephen.
Oh yeah, cheers to cheers to Stephen.
Stephen
Stainer.
You did it.
You didn't
kill anyone else. He didn't.
That seems so foreboding for some reason. It almost
I'm
seems,
just telling
almost
Joel
seems like,
that he didn't. That's all.
Almost seems like foreshadowing.
No, it's not even a thing. I'm just like, I thought maybe that's what Joel was thinking, so I said no.
That's what I thought at first until I finished the research. I was like, holy shit, there's no way this guy didn't murder four people in Yosemite National Park.
Because that's where our mind goes.
That's what happened.
Because we've read so much about true crime. It's like, okay, this is the type of guy that is for sure going
that he would
to
end up doing. He'd end up
here's
fucking.
This is for sure
PTSD
the type of guy that is going to decapitate a woman and stick her in the trunk of a car and set the car
and
on
set
fire.
The car on fire. He would not do that.
No, Stephen Stainer wouldn't do that.
But no, he really didn't. I promise.
He didn't.
No, I'm serious.
You were going to find out.
Okay.
I'm serious.
You are
okay.
going to find
out
by the end of this episode.
That? Someone okay. does it connected. I'll just get you out of your misery. Someone does it that's connected
to the
story,
but
it's
not. But there's so many people who
him.
Have been murdered in national parks that you can't narrow that down to a,
why does,
a specific
by the way,
person.
Why does anyone go to Yosemite at this point?
Why does anybody go to any national
any
park?
National
do you
park.
Realize how many people go missing in national parks?
Is that where it happens the most?
Thankfully, yeah. Thankfully,
it's
I'm
shocking.
Not into any of that stuff.
Oh, no, I don't
Wait,
go
so
outside
what happened
to
fucking
to.
Fuckface? Juice, after they turned him, after they got away.
Oh, yes, okay.
Oh, we'll find out.
We'll get into that. But
okay.
What I wanted to say
he had
about
a happy
like,
ending.
What I wanted to say about my where my mind goes is, have you guys ever seen the documentary about Mr. Rogers? Like Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood?
I never watched it. Or no, I did, but I was too
the one
hammered.
With Tom Hanks?
No, like the real one before.
Oh, the actual documentary.
So the whole time, this is the way my mind works. The whole time I'm waiting for them to tell me.
That's what I did.
Fucked up thing that Mr. Rogers did. And he did nothing. And I was like,
perfect angel.
Dude, fuck this, right? Like, it's like, boring.
What a wuss.
Just like an awesome dude that like did amazing stuff, changed the world. That, like,
that's something that I've brought up on Iconoblast so many times.
He's the only one.
I have tried to find dirt on Mr. Rogers, and the more I learn about him, the more I love him.
Yeah. The deeper you dig, you're like, oh my God, I fucking love him more now.
I think that he is the only pure human to ever exist throughout the 300 years that we have been Homo sapiens.
Yeah, him and OJ, but like other than that, it's like...
I mean, that's a given. That's like talking about Jesus.
Angels.
Innocent angels.
Orenthal Jesus Simpson.
Yes. But in Steven's case, you can rest assured that
Steven Stainer did not murder anyone.
It's amazing that he turned out the way that he did.
He did good. Yeah, he learned from what. Well, that's a fucked up way to say it, but he's fucked up from it. But he's using that energy in a positive
instead of being negative. Medicated and pissed off and. Doing crazy shit himself. Yeah.
Getting arrested.
He was turning his life. He was trying to just be a family man.
Became a Mormon?
Became a Mormon.
He did kind of fuck up a little bit.
What are you talking about? That's like the purest form of Christian that you can be.
I mean, there's some adjacent stuff with it, though, we're not loving, but go ahead.
Oh, so they committed a slaughter way back in the day. That was so long ago.
No, I'm talking about LDS.
I am too. The Mormons slaughtered a bunch of innocent settlers back in like the 1800s.
Yeah, I was talking about the LDS, the Latter-day Saints, Mormon adjacent.
I thought they were the...
Isn't the same shit?
Yeah, it's the same thing.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, the Church of Jesus Christ and Latter-day Saints, it's the same thing as Mormon. I mean, there's offshoots of...
That's what I mean.
Mormons? Yeah, there's the...
There's some real shitty...
The polygamous Mormons.
Mormons have more than one wife?
I'm talking about mainstream Mormons.
Mainstream Mormons, no. LDS, yes, go.
So, Stephen's story was turned into a television miniseries called I Know My First Name is Stephen. And the series aired on NBC on May 21st and 22nd of 1989, with Stephen himself playing the role of one of the policemen who escorted him to see his family for the first time since his abduction.
Whoa.
Yeah, and his family said, like, that day on set was, like, pretty fucking amazing. Like, having him play the police officer that's, like, saving
and reintroducing him to his family.
Yeah.
That's cool. It's
crazy.
You can still find the full show? Series online, and you can also find recordings of the producer, writer, and director discussing how they're going to portray his character.
Right.
And it's interesting, but it's also – I thought that it felt kind of disturbing to me because the writer's like, oh, so this is probably what he was going through at this time. So the way that we maximize on this is I need to write it in this way. And, you know, he needs to...
You need to feel this way about his... You do.
Yeah.
But it's... You never think of it in those terms. And then I think they got the parents, like, kind of weirdly wrong. And so the dad was really pissed off about the movie.
What did they make? They made him a hero and a good person. They was like, wait, that's not me.
No.
I never hugged my son.
Yeah, exactly.
What the fuck?
I think they made him, like... So they made the mom, like... Just this, like, super doting mom that was just, like, housewife, amazing. And they made – but that she also, like, urged the dad to, you know, whip the kids when they were bad or whatever. And then the dad was just this totally unfeeling, like – which, by the way, I don't think it was super not accurate. But when the dad saw it, was, like, obviously pissed off.
I don't need my wife to tell me to beat my children.
I'm a man. He was like, she never fucking told me. I did it on my own. Yeah.
Stephen and his new family continued to live in Merced, California, where he worked at a pizza parlor. He purchased... Stayed in Merced.
I would have got the fuck out of there.
How fucking crazy is that, right?
I think I would want to get the hell out of there, too.
100%.
Stephen purchased a motorcycle and spent his time focusing on creating a normal life for himself and his brand new family. Then, on September 16th, 1989... Only 9 years after escaping from Kenneth Parnell, Stephen's motorcycle collided with a car as he was driving home from work. The driver of the car fled the scene, and Stephen Stainer was left to die from a fatal head injury.
What the fuck?
But he died. He didn't do anything else wrong. It was a motorcycle accident. I'm sorry, but you have a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Wait, how long later was this?
Nine years.
He was only 24 years old. He was free for 9 years and then died in a freak motorcycle accident.
Was he happy at the time?
Considering by all accounts, his kids were like, he was the best as happy as you can be.
Yeah, his kids don't really have anything.
No, they bad do to say interviews. Like his daughter's like super into true crime. Like they do interviews. They loved him. He was the best. Like
okay, good.
Yeah.
That's like, a good way to go then.
Like, look, it's gonna happen.
Just ripping, dude. He was just ripping. Everybody's gonna
die on a 24 drunk. Yeah. It was probably wheelie into the car. Yeah. But
that's
he was living it.
Everyone's gonna die on a motorcycle eventually.
Exactly.
Same thing happened to Arnold, but he lived.
Wait, in real life?
Yeah. When he was governor, he crashed head on into a car on his motorcycle. Remember for
and
a
just,
while
like, got
he
got up
that,
and like shook it off.
He had a mark on his face. It was
of course the five person family in the car that he crashed into.
All dead.
He killed them.
Totally.
No, it was dead. A T-bone. He T-boned a car. And he flew over the car and landed on the ground on the other side and just got up. It was like, my nose is a little bit
red. Yeah. He put a little fucking butterfly Band-Aid on it and just like went
million
to
dollars worth of damages to the road.
Everybody else is
in
dead.
The street, the car.
He actually, it wasn't even the motorcycle. Like him falling on the ground, like dented that. Like,
yeah, the street still has a dent.
The street still has the dent. Car totally fine.
Following Stephen's death, over 500 people attended his funeral. 14-year-old Timothy White acted as one of his pallbearers, forever grateful that Stephen saved him from Kenneth Parnell. Timothy White went on to become a deputy for the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, well as giving lectures to children about the dangers of kidnapping. So he kind of followed in Stephen's footsteps.
That's badass.
Letting kids know, like, hey, don't trust some random dude that comes up and says, like, hey, does your mom want to donate any furniture to a church?
Because
they will straight up kidnap
him. He got it a little bit, too, those 16 days he was there.
No, he didn't.
Apparently, Stephen, like, totally saved him and, like, completely...
Stopped it every time?
Stopped it and kept him with him.
Fuck yeah.
Timothy White has maintained
Stephen's
that,
a hero.
That,
yeah, dude.
And he went out like a fucking superhero.
Yeah, dude.
He went out, well, kind of like James Dean, but
yeah, like a
champ.
Yeah.
It's a champion death. I'll give it to him.
Yeah.
I mean, I could choose worse ways.
The fact
to
that
die.
He bought a motorcycle is cool.
And I hope he was boozing, right?
Yeah, so smoking, like... drinking, jacking, jerking, motorcycle, boom! He's the fucking best.
Smoking, drinking, jacking, jerking is the new title of the episode. But love it.
And then in parentheses,
the 70s.
Kenneth Parnell, the villain of our story, was arrested and convicted for the kidnapping of Stephen Stainer and Timothy White. Unfortunately, due to a bunch of bureaucratic bullshit, he was given a 7-year sentence and never charged with the sexual assault he had committed against Stephen Stainer.
Yeah, really? And Stephen had to...
Is it because Stephen wouldn't admit it that he did it?
No,
it
was a combination of some of the assaults being past the statute of limitations, and then also it was outside of the jurisdiction of Merced, California.
So with combining all those things in the years and the whatever, it equaled this insane amount that everyone was pissed about, but the 70s.
That's still the same, though.
Yeah, but that would fucking never happen.
Laws
right
changed
now.
Specifically because of this case.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
And he finally testified against him, which he did not want to do, obviously, right? He didn't want to get up on the stand and see him and talk about, like, because he was still, in a way, a little bit scared of him. So he ended up getting on the stand, going through all of this again, like, talking about it, trying to get him convicted, and then finding out that in 5 years, he will be back on the streets. So
well, he got a 7-year sentence, but he was paroled after 5 years. Mm-hmm. He spent less time in custody. He spent less time in prison than Stephen Stainer spent being abused by him.
Is that fucking crazy?
That's fucked.
That is,
again, like, this is one of those cases
ridiculous.
That changed a lot of things. So like good ultimately came from it, but the fact that all of this shit had to happen in order for laws to change and sentences and the it's way stupid. That we...
That's human nature.
Yeah, it's...
Everything has to go wrong before you'll fix it. If it ain't broke.
Yes, or if it doesn't like directly affect you, you're not you don't care do about it, yeah.
Spoiler alert, everything about this story is tragic. Whoa. From start to finish, there's no...
What happening. Happens to this fucking guy then? He gets out, then what? So well, he gets out in what year?
Parnell's, he was released 5 years after being sentenced. He got out like before 1990.
Were they living in the same town then? Because he didn't die until 9 years later.
No, we'll get into it.
Oh, okay.
Parnell's accomplices, Edward Murphy and Randall Poorman, were both convicted of lesser charges. Stephen later said that Murphy was kind to him and felt that he was just as much of a victim of Parnell's manipulation as he was. Thankfully, Parnell didn't entirely escape justice. In 2004, at 71 years old, Kenneth Parnell was once again arrested, this time for trying to purchase a 4-year-old boy from his caretaker for $500. Parnell was already, his health was already failing.
And so he had a caretaker,
and he was trying to get his caretaker to help him purchase a 4-year-old child for $500.
And this is why, to this day, the sentences are longer, because they are proven to... You know, they would just get out and do it again. It's not something that you just go like, oh, so, sorry, not into that anymore.
Oh, there's no, I'm totally not into that. Totally not until into kids anymore.
Yeah, I know. I'm
not
sure.
Until he was 71 I'm in sure 2004.
Was that was the only time he got caught.
Exactly
only time he
right.
got caught. I think that that's bitch. The case also.
Exactly right.
I hate this guy.
Why? He just loves children. Fred Rogers loved children.
Oh, not I bet the same you party way, with him, though.
I go to a party with him.
You
so
go
I can
to
kill
a
him.
Party.
Like, oh, I thought you meant that Kenneth Parnell and Fred Rogers partied together. And I was like, that would be a wild fucking party.
Jeez, death match.
Make them fight each other, yeah.
So during the trial, two surprise witnesses were called to the stand. One of them being Timothy White, his former victim. And other witness was none other than Randall Poorman, the person who had helped abduct Timothy when he was only 5 years old.
The other teenager?
Yeah.
Yes.
So it was Stephen Stainer's teenage friend that had helped abduct who'd Timothy because Stephen was sabotaging all of the abductions, so he got Randall Poorman. This was the first time that Randall Poorman and Timothy White had seen each other since Randall Poorman had...
Literally dragged him
into a car. At the trial, Timothy White and Randall Poorman spoke for the first time since Timothy's kidnapping all those years ago. Timothy embraced Randall and told him that he forgave him, giving both of them a little bit of closure to the horrific events of their childhoods.
Wow, that takes
some fucking
balls.
Now, did Randall do anything
balls.
Else? He was just kind of a little druggy kid, right?
Yeah,
he just got tricked, got free cigarettes and 20
and
bucks.
Drugs.
He got some weed too, so give him a little bit of leeway. Back in the 70s, weed was a little bit harder to come by.
Hardcore.
Yeah. So Kenneth Parnell was convicted.
And there was probably some bullshit story where he didn't know that kid was going to get fucked with.
He was literally like,
grab this kid from me. I need to tell him to go to church.
Yeah, Parnell
he
like,
was
had
manipulating
a way.
Everybody. Yeah. Yeah.
He had a way of being like, just get him in the car. He's going down the wrong path. I need to get him. Like,
I'm
going to
save
church.
His life.
Exactly right.
So Kenneth Parnell was convicted of attempting to purchase a child and sentenced to life in prison in 2004. He died of natural causes 4 years later at the California Medical Facility in Vacaville, California.
After being fucking raped 1,000 times by the guards and staff.
I hope
to God that's the case, but... He is literally he's the villain of the story, and he is the only person that dies of natural causes. He's the only person that lives a full life.
Right.
Motherfucker.
Timothy White died on April 1st, 2010, from a pulmonary embolism at the age of 35.
Damn it. Timmy.
What is that? Is that the shit that happens if you go to the recall place in Total Recall? Schizoid embolism.
Yeah. He went to Total Recall to relive his time as a spy on Mars and just
yeah.
fried his brain.
Yeah. Obvi.
What is it actually, though?
Sort of like a.
I think it's like a stroke. It's like you have something.
Your brain just stops working.
Burst somewhere.
His brain exploded.
Yeah.
It's like from Scanners.
Okay.
Life, being the cruel mistress it is, allowed the villain of the story to be the only one to live a full life.
Bitch.
On August 28th, 2010, a statue of Stephen Stainer and Timothy White was erected in Applegate Park in Merced, California. Another statue was later dedicated to Stephen and Timothy by the residents of Ukiah. Both statues depict 14-year-old Stephen holding the hand of 5-year-old Timothy, leading him to safety as he had all those years ago.
That's good. I like that.
But this isn't the end of the story. Throughout all of this, Stephen's older brother, Kerry Stainer, was in the background, neglected and suffering abuses of his own. This would eventually lead to the second tragedy to befall the Stainer family, which we will cover in the next episode.
Oh, God.
Little teaser. So, discussion time on that is if anyone's going to become, you know, a crazy, like, murderer. That's what I mean. We're going to say some people died.
Theoretically, we're just spitballing here.
Mm-hmm. We're just spitballing.
It's his brother. I thought you were going to say it was his kids or something. That's what I kept thinking.
No.
You don't
know
yet?
But, like, every other, I will say, like, every other person in the story, like, you're thinking Timothy White. If he becomes a murderer, you go, I get it, right?
Makes sense.
Randall, he becomes a, I get it. Fucking Stephen, if he, like, becomes, you know, is, like, crazy, starts doing the things that were done to him, whatever, you go, fine, I understand that.
Yeah, you can kind of see the process.
You were bummed. You weren't.
I saw your little hints at the older brother having some problems.
So sad.
Yes. I mean, there's other things involved that actually happened to Kerry as well, but.
Yeah, we'll get into that in the next. The oldest.
Okay,
the older
brother's
name is.
Kerry Stainer.
Kerry Stainer. Okay.
Kerry Stainer.
So the story of Stephen and Kerry Stainer.
Of course, you have a hard life. His name's Kerry.
Right? It's like having a boy named Sue. You think it's going to make you tough? It just turns you into a fucking murderer.
And I think the title of that episode needs to be like, wrong kid died or something like that. Because that's like the reasoning that people give behind everything. But we will cover that in the next episode, and I'm going to take that.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a really interesting story also, because the timeline is what shocked me the most.
Yeah.
Because the second half of this episode is astoundingly recent.
Yes.
Considering that the first part happened back in the 70s.
Right.
And it wasn't concluded until, you know, the mid to late 80s.
Yeah, so then the next episode, also alternate title, Aw the 80s, right? We can find some other holes in the system that could only happen in the 80s.
Yes. True. I think it's kind of the same holes that just hadn't been plugged
properly. Yeah. So between the Stainer family, I think, you know, was hugely responsible for plugging all the holes in the child abduction, murdering, whatever.
Good.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, good word usage.
If you didn't get it.
There was a really tasteless joke I could have made there, trying
the
to keep
holes.
It clean.
Yeah, it got real quiet because
we're all thinking the same thing here.
Look.
We're all recently reformed dirtbags.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry. Anyways, thank you for joining us on the Stephen and Kerry Stainer case, colon, all the 70s, part one.
Part one, yeah.
Episode two of Jesse Wiseman's Crime Corner.
Subtitle, The Baron Stainer Brothers.
That's unbelievable.
I want everyone to we should end the episode with everyone just imagining Stephen doing a wheelie on the motorcycle, but he's also standing.
He's standing.
He's got his hands out, reached out as far as he can, like a cross.
A stick, a beer.
He's got a stick in one hand and a beer in the other.
Freebird is just
a drag,
blaring in the
background. Closes his eyes, and
boom.
Happily ever after for him.
Right?
Yeah.
It maybe had to end that way.
Rest in peace, Stephen Stainer.
Yeah.
Hero. Joel was having a hard time with that one. He may not want to do
it. I almost fucking cried at one.